You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Archaeological Fantasies Podcast, episode 83. I'm your host, Sarah Head, with my co-hosts today, Ken Fader and Jeb Card. And today we're talking to special guests Roxanne Davila and Marcello Canuto. We're discussing the Ichimaya. Who were they? Where did they come from? And what did P.T. Barnum have to do with all this? Get ready to think critically.
No, we don't do dinosaurs. No, we don't do dinosaurs. No, we don't do dinosaurs. Ranger trials, as one will call. No, we don't do dinosaurs.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Archaeological Fantasies Podcast. I am your host, Sarah Head, and I am joined today by Jeb Card and Ken Fader. How's it going, guys?
It's going fantastic.
Doing all right.
Yeah. Jeff is a little Mary Sunshine, so things are always spectacular in Jeff.
Yes, yeah, of course.
And we have a pretty full house today because we are joined by two special guests today. We have Roxanne Davila and Marcello Canuto. So, Roxanne, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and why we brought you on our show?
Sure. Well, I have been working on a project that is actually going to eventually be a book that looks at early travelers to the Maya ruins, early 19th century travelers. So before the ancient Maya were really introduced to the broader public. And I look at many different elements of these travelers, why they were going, why different countries at this time, especially European as well as the United States, were interested in what we now call the Maya area. And part of that project examines an exhibit done by P.T. Barnum of the Barnum Circus fame that capitalizes on the popularity, if you will, and interest in the ancient civilizations of Central America and then also of Central Mexico, the Aztecs. So it was a big hoax, but it is a brilliant attempt to try to commercialize and capitalize on the interest that the 19th century reading public had in this area at that time. So that's sort of a general context. It's part of a larger project. And my primary interest is really in the 1820s and 1830s. So, but that also feeds into what will eventually become Barnum's hoax, his live exhibits, of which Ichimaya is one of them. So, and
so
I shall just mention also
that... Sorry, you're ending your book with Catherwood and Stevens then.
Exactly. Instead of using them as the starting point, which is the canonical way to approach, you know, the history of Maya studies, I end with him. I look at what's going on and what leads up to Stevens and Catherwood.
And Marcello, can you tell us why we brought you on our show as well?
Hello. My name is Marcello Canuto. I'm an archaeologist and a professor at Tulane University. And my focus is on Maya civilization. I've been an archaeologist working in the Maya area since I was about 15 years old, actually. So I've been doing this for quite a long time. And one of the fascinating things that I like about the research, one aspect of my research, of course, is the history of our discipline and how we got to where we got. How did our intellectual ancestors get to ask the questions that we then try to answer and then down the line. So I'm always very interested in seeing how previous scholars got to do what we try to do, also in different contexts, different technological contexts, and so forth. So one of the aspects of my interest in all of this is just sort of seeing how our discipline has progressed over the last 200 years, from the earliest travelers into the region to explorations or excavations that are happening now. So that's one of my interests.
All right. Well, so today we are talking about Ichimaya.
Ichimaya.
Help me out here.
Ichimaya. Let's start right off the top. Where does that word come from?
That's a very good question, and it's actually not really clear. I mean, it is referenced in the pamphlet that accompanied the exhibit of these young children. It means great city, as far as the narrative suggests, but I'm actually Ichimaya... the word Maya, of course, is included in that. And Ishi, I don't know if anyone has a sense for what the Ishi.
Well, Ish IX in Maya tends to be a prefix that relates to female or woman.
Yeah, it's the female agentive, yeah.
It's a female agentive. And so, but the extra E doesn't make much sense. It would just be Ish Maya if it would be a woman. So I think it, frankly, is a mishmash, and it's something that sounded to folks back 200 years ago as potentially Maya. It also kind of Ishim, IXIM, the X is pronounced as sh, means corn. So it could be a game of Ishim for corn and Maya, and then we just use two M's. And so corn, Maya, you know, it all fits in with just a general conception of what the Maya were like, you know.
I would bet it probably is the female agentive, because Ishchel would probably be showing up in sort of books of Maya culture and so forth.
So, Roxanne, could you tell us about what is this fake exhibit? Who are the Aztec children really, and what were they purported to be by the folks exhibiting them?
Okay, excellent question. I'm actually going to start from not necessarily the beginning, because what is the beginning really, but I want to give a context as to what is going on during this period of the 1840s, 50s, mm-hmm. and 60s. Because Barnum's exhibit is an 1860 exhibit, but the Aztec Lilliputians, these Aztec Maya, as they were referred to, were actually being exhibited as early as the 1850s in Europe and then in Boston and in New York. But what we have going on in the United States is an interest, a very specific interest in Central America, largely due to the popularity of John Lloyd Stevens. Now, he's known mostly and mainly as a very successful travel writer. He's been credited as the first explorer to accurately describe the ancient Maya. He's been credited as the, quote, creator of the concept of a Maya region. He uses the word Maya, which typically is usually referring to the Yucatecan Maya. And then, of course, there are the other 23 groups of Maya. But John Lloyd Stevens is actually a very successful businessman in New York. His family owned a shipping company, and he is actually summoned by President Van Buren, that is the President of the United States at the time, to make an exploratory trip down to Central America to try to locate the center of the government. Now, you have to understand that this is a very chaotic time in Central America. The Federation has fallen. What we now know is the different Central American countries, they were part of a larger federation until that collapsed in the 1840s. And so there's chaos. And one would ask, why does Van Buren care about what, you know, where the center of the government is? And there were very specific interests in this area because commerce, what we now know as the Panama Canal, was going to start off as the Panama Railroad. And whoever was able to develop that area was going to have a shortcut for trade. They wouldn't have to go all the way down to Tierra del Fuego and go around and then reach what is, you know, now known as California. They could just go straight through. So there's a very specific commercial interest. Stevens, by chance, is also a very talented, very gifted travel writer. He had published numerous travel narratives before. And so he heads down to this area and decides to also record his travels in the travel narratives that are then published in the 1840s. And they become truly one of the first bestsellers in U.S. reading history. They sell thousands of copies, what would be equivalent to the New York Times bestsellers in our modern day. He publishes two volumes on Central America, and then he returns and does another trip in the Yucatan area, which of course is of interest for commerce as well, Yucatan being able to navigate around that peninsula. And it's also very important to mention that he was accompanied by a British artist who did what are considered to be almost impeccable drawings, the very, very accurate drawings as seen by contemporary archaeologists of the Maya sculpture, of the glyphs that one sees in places like Palenque. So it was really the combination of what we now consider a field archaeologist and archaeological illustrator or epigrapher, if you will. That model, that pairing of the two is born, at least to the general public, with these two travelers. So they go down, they're very successful, the books come back. They sell a lot, and there is a vast interest in this area by the general public. And what ensues, Barnum being who he is, he's already a very successful entertainer. He has his Barnum's Museum in New York City, which will eventually burn, but it was one of the central attractions in New York City. He was actually from Connecticut. He was from Bridgeport, but his museum was in New York City, and he sees an opportunity to capitalize on this interest in Central America when he encounters these two microcephalic, meaning that they have a particularly cone-shaped head. This has actually been in, I think, recent discussions because of the Zika virus. That was one of the side effects
right.
of
right,
the,
right.
So people are a little more familiar with what that is now than in previous years. But he reads, he learns about an exhibit, a traveling exhibit of two children who are purported to be brother and sister from a lost city in the jungles. There's a fusion of Aztec and Maya. They're Aztec children, but they're coming from a Maya area in many ways to engage the public, right, with both Aztec. We should remember also that William Prescott's The Conquest of Mexico was an extraordinarily successful book in 1843, the same time that Stevens actually published his travel narratives about the Maya. So there's a vast interest in both Mexico and Central America for pleasure reading as well as for commerce. So Barnum, what he does is that he acquires these two children who had already been exhibited all over Europe. There were viewings with Queen Victoria, with Prince Albert, with all different kinds of scientists, investigators as well, in Boston, and then eventually in New York. And he decides to stage one of his live exhibits, which were part of Barnum's 1860s move towards bringing race into his exhibits and to engaging the public in the pre-Civil War era in the United States. So this is known as his Aztec Wonders. The children were actually originally, there's some dispute as to whether they were from Guatemala or from El Salvador. They were Central American. They did have these cone-shaped heads. So they were said, the narrative that was sold to the public and what was shown to the public was in fact two children who were part of a priest, a sacerdotal caste in this lost city of Ishimaya, there was never any contact with U.S. or West European explorers. And it's a chance for the public to see this live. So, it's a fascinating exhibit that combines so many different elements of culture, of readings of race, and interest in archaeology all into one particular show. And Barnum, it was one of his most successful human live exhibits. The public could interact with these siblings, his brother and sister. There are numerous photographs from the mid to late 19th century where they're posed in front of pyramids. But it's a fusion of interest in Stevens and Catherwood, and then, of course, this idea of encountering the remnants of a lost city, which will be something that will be developed over and over again in the 19th century. So that's just a very general introduction. But there was a pamphlet also that I'm sure you will be interested in talking about that accompanied the exhibit that actually presented a travel narrative, if you will, about the discovery of these two children, Maximo and Bartola. So,
if I can chime in here for 1 second, Roxanne.
Sure.
I love the pamphlet. It's wonderful. And what I find, P.T. Barnum is a Connecticut favorite son.
I know.
There is a Barnum Museum in Bridgeport. It was Barnum's building.
I've been there.
And Kathy Marr, who's the director, is a wonderful person. We should have her on the show. What's fascinating to me is here it's 1860, and in the booklet, Barnum, in fact, has the writer write, not merely imaginary creatures like the strange men of Africa mentioned by Herodotus, The Phoenix or the Mermaid. 1841, P.T. Barnum is exhibiting the Fiji Mermaid.
Right.
Telling people
right.
it's real. So right. So certainly the modern world is not the first time we've had people who say one thing today and something else tomorrow right. and believe that you should believe both of those things.
Right, exactly. And, you know, and with this memoir, it's fascinating because, I mean, the title is very long, but he actually references Stevens, one of the authors, or shall I say editors of this pamphlet. It's a short pamphlet. It's, you know, depending on which edition you see, it's between 35 and 50 pages because right. they were already circulating in the 1850s. But it's John L. Stevens with a V. Mm-hmm. Instead of with a PH, so that there's, you know, no proprietary, but it's immediately referencing that particular author, you know, to give it authenticity, validity. It's based on a supposed diary of a Salvadorian traveler who accompanied the original Canadian and American explorer to find these Ishimaya. And one very important thing, just relating this back to Stevens and Catherwood, this whole exhibit is born out of a short paragraph in The Incidents of Travel in Central America by John Lloyd Stevens, where he mentions that a priest, a padre, tells him about a lost city of the Candones, of course, referring to the La Candones, right? This is in the Chiapas, but that he does not have time to go in and try to find this lost city, untouched Indians, indigenous people, but that future explorers might be interested in this. So the managers that eventually go on and acquire these children and exhibit them, even before Barnum acquires them, are very much aware of that reference in Stevens. And it's a way to sell, we found them. Look, you can come and see them live. You can interact with them. You can, you know, they're small. They're not threatening. They're, you know, but they're the real deal. So, you know, it's I think it's fast because the Fiji Mermaid, you know, in some of his 1840 exhibits were not interactive, right? You would go and see the Fiji right. Mermaid, you know, and then he moves, moves, you know, in the 1850s and 60s, primarily in the 60s, into these live exhibits. This is just one of many, you know, there's the Monkey Man, you know, see the beginning of humanity. And this is when race was very much part of the discussion in the United States, right? Because we're leading up to the Civil War and discussions about slavery and all of this. So it's my admiration of Barnum, if you will, for just being so aware of everything uh-huh. that was going on at the time and very well read too, in the sense that there's an awareness of, you know, Stevens. I think that many middle class readers were reading Stevens at this time too. So but yeah, the pamphlet is really quite a fascinating text.
And there's an overt comparison between Maya imagery of with a cranial deformation and the sloping foreheads and the actual shape of the heads of these Aztec children.
Absolutely. And that's a way of authenticating the exhibit
sure.
because what he does, what the pamphlet does, better said, is that he makes reference to Catherwood's drawings of the Temple of the Cross reliefs, which are these magnificent reliefs at Palenque in Chiapas in Mexico, and some of the other carved stones in the same site where they actually show exaggerated I don't know, I can't think of a better word, but the what would be comparable to what you see in a microcephalic child or person. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's a way, once again, of authenticating. You are actually going to see what Catherwood drew from these ancient temples. It, you know, and so the drawings, they're new. It's at the very beginning where he includes those drawings from, they're all reliefs from Palenque.
And those specific reliefs, I mean, Catherwood reproduces them, but those were probably some of the earliest pieces, I mean, not even the Catherwood pieces, but some of the earliest pieces of Maya art that were shown outside the Maya regions. You have Juan Galindo in Palenque, mm-hmm. who is one of the first Maya archaeology explorers that shows them, and Waldeck, who also emphasizes those. So, I mean, if you were looking for what something that was supposed to look Maya looked for much of the night, today we think of Stele and we think of big pyramids, but those would have actually been the image of the Maya really until the latter part of the 19th century.
You're absolutely right. And I'm so glad you bring up, well, Galindo is my personal favorite. I have a entire chapter on him. He's a fascinating figure. He is a naturalized Central American who originated in Ireland. I know the show isn't about Galindo, but he is. I do have an article about him, and he's an extremely interesting figure. He does some of the first drawings and actually posits that there is a phonetic element to the Maya language. These are things that are in diaries. And then Waldeck, Jean Frederick Waldeck, is a French-Prussian explorer who did extraordinary work. He is actually written off usually as, you know, as a wacko, a lunatic, something that would be of interest actually for the audience listening here, because he, in his finished work, his paintings, he was a very gifted draftsman, but he also then transformed those early drawings into paintings that he exhibited in London and in Paris primarily. He makes the transition. He puts Greek boys standing in front of the pyramids. He puts elephants into some of his drawings. And that's what he's become known for, when in fact, if you look at his original drawings that are in the Newberry Library or in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, they're fantastically, to use that word in a different way, accurate in terms of the way in which he recorded the detail. The elephants are there, but it's also a very new visual vocabulary for a European artist coming into. And of course, all of these, and this is referenced in the pamphlet too, there is the topic of origin of these indigenous people that is circulating since the late 18th century, when you have the first expeditions to Palenque. Where did they come from? You know, what are they doing there? Are they Assyrian? Are they Egyptian? Eventually, are they related to Mu? I know, Jeb, that you've actually studied, you know, the concept of Mu.
Right.
In great detail. There's also Kingsborough, who was Waldeck's patron, who believed that there's the lost tribe of Israel in the Maya area. While it sounds absurd to a modern audience, it's all part of an intellectual dialogue about the origins of these people. Where did they come from? And the references that this public has to antiquity is precisely that, Egyptian, Assyrian. And that's what is referenced actually in this pamphlet too. There's discussions about the origins of these people. So it's a fascinating compilation.
What's cool in the pamphlet though is after they bring up all these possibilities, their conclusion is that they are a completely distinctive and separate race. Mm-hmm. So they're not related to the Jews or Siberians or Indians or Egyptians, but they are so distinctive that they are entirely separate, which is pretty interesting.
That's something that Stevens himself kind of famously concluded on his own when he did his trip through Central America, and it was one of those moments where it was he's credited as being one of the first to actively make that statement about the ancient civilizations of Central America, that there was no need to look outside of that area to find the ancestors of this particular civilization. And so it's interesting that this particular riff, if you will, this pamphlet, this riff off of what Stevens brings back to the public in the United States, keeps that part of it, you know, intact. And we were talking about this earlier, and one of the fascinating aspects of all of this is how the one thing that they decide to focus on, the way that they decide to publicize, it's almost like fan fiction, right? They decide to take this travel writing and then add to it and riff off of it to make their own exhibit. The trope that they decide to focus on is the lost city. They take one small, very almost insignificant passage in Stevens. You know, as archaeologists, my archaeologists, we look at Stevens and Catherwood and we study what they said and where they went and the drawings and so forth. This particular passage is not of great import, but it's to us today, but it was something that they decided to really develop off of for this particular exhibit, which I find fascinating. You know, that they said, well, this is something we can really sell, right? The idea of, oh, there's a lost city somewhere. Well, let's say we found it and then create a whole narrative around that. It kind of works off of Stevens without having to contradict him or entirely make up something, which I from a distance is cool.
Let's go to break real quick, and when we come back, we can start focusing on some of these other traits that were brought up through this pamphlet, no less.
This network is supported by our listeners. You can become a supporting member by going to arcpodnet.com/members and signing up. As a supporting member, you have access to high-quality downloads of each show and a discount at our future online store, and access to show hosts on a members-only Slack team. For professional members, we'll have training shows and other special content offered throughout the year. Once again, go to arcpodnet.com/members to support the network and get some great extras and swag in the process. That's arcpodnet.com/members.
Hey, everyone, and we are back. And Ken, you had a question before we went to break.
Right, yeah. I mean, these two children, these are human beings, clearly who didn't have the ability to give informed consent that, oh yeah, we'd love to portray two Aztec children. First of all, how were they obtained, and what happened to them?
It's a very good question, and it's actually a question that is of great interest today, because there was definitely exploitation. And they were apparently obtained, their mother, there are different stories, but their mother in El Salvador sold them to a traveler who then was advised within El Salvador that he should take them and exhibit them in Europe and then bring them to the United States, which is what he ended up doing. And then Barnum actually acquired them later, because Barnum was quite astute, I think, when it came to knowing what would interest the public, what would make him money, but also what would be of great interest for entertainment, you know, as well as cultural interest. But I think Barnum was really focused in on the entertainment. They were not capable of giving informed consent, as Ken just said. So they were not necessarily aware. There have been, you know, comments, different articles suggesting that, you know, of course, this is, you know, there's a racism implicit there, which of course there was, as well as, you know, it's taking advantage of young children with, you know, mental exceptionalities. But if you accept that, you know, as this 19th century trope and what was going on scientifically, you can follow them into the 20th century. They lived, I believe it was Bartola, or one of them died earlier, but they were both photographed and studied in a, quote, scientific manner into the 1920s. They're photographs from the early 20th century of Maximo and Bartola as adults. And these are very much in tune with what was going on with ethnographic photography of otherness and interest in otherness. But it shifts away from the entertainment value to scientific inquiry, but fitting very well within this sort of nascent field of anthropology and, you know, ethnographic, and the publications coming out of, you know, of the United States and Europe around that.
These were not the only people that were put on display in this manner. I mean, there's famously Otobenga. There's literally, I just looked up in Wikipedia, an entire entry on human zoos in the early 20th, late 19th century of people that were put on display because they were considered to be from exotic places around the world.
Absolutely.
And there were other Aztec children, other people with microcephaly, I guess inspired by Barnum's exhibit, who then were portrayed in circuses. Schlitzy, who was a performer with microcephaly, who shows up in Todd Browning's movie Freaks, which is like a cult classic now. There's photographs of him with captions indicating the last of the Aztec children, and that's into the mid-1930s.
And that's a trope that continues into the 40s. There's Pip and Flip, who were the two sisters at the Coney, who are a sideshow at the Coney Island Circus, and their photographs that circulated, there were these sort of mementos that visitors would take home with them. This is in the 30s and the 40s. And then most recently, this is actually one of Martello's students who told me about this, because I haven't watched American Horror Show, but it's a very popular show, that in the most recent season, which focused in on, quote, freaks, right? This, I think it's actually dialoguing with the film that Ken just mentioned, but there is actually a character that is specifically, her name is Pepper, I learned, but it's a reference to the Pip and Flip from the Coney Islands. And there's a constant connection with this idea of being ancient Maya. So it works all the way into this past year. in terms of popular entertainment. You know, now it's on TV, but, you know,
The article that was written, the scientific article that was written by Rudolf Virchow, who was a German scholar, refers to them as Aztecs still. So even 50 years, this was in 1901, it was published.
That's the famous one, yeah, with the photographs, yeah.
And 50 years later, after this, all of this stuff, they were still being referred to as Aztecs. So it became part of their identity in the United States, or their scientific identity. When we all know that Aztecs is a term that is has very little to do with any actual people or any kind of ethnicity of any kind.
Well, I know we've mentioned that particular concept on the show before, especially with Jeb, but would you like to refresh people's memory about why Aztec is not actually a culture group?
Well, it ends up being one of these names that hit that become very common the Spanish incursions, thanks to the Spanish invasion of Mexico, and their confusion as to what kinds of people, and their kind of ham-handed or clumsy attempts at trying to understand the history of the areas that they were conquering in the 1500s. One scholar I remember telling me that said, well, frankly, they couldn't pronounce the sh sound that the Mexica said, which was the name that they referred to themselves as when they came, hence the term Mexico. And so they said, well, we can't pronounce that the sh sound, so where do you come from? And the mythology was that they came from a place called Aztlan. And so the word Aztec was born as those people who come from Aztlan. That's just one of many ways that it's been described. But essentially, it was a term given to a group of people by the Spaniards, not an indigenous name that they referred to themselves as. And this has just come down through the centuries. And it has become the term that now we use for everything that has to do with Mexico conquest, sacrifice, and large empires. Right? It's sort of synonymous with all these kinds of ideas.
Sort of the dawn of history in Mexico.
The dawn of right, because these and of course we now know from our own research that is not even true from the perspective of hieroglyphic texts and so forth that predate the Mexica or the Aztecs, quote unquote. But it is a term that has now become used so widely that it is used. But it's an odd term that if you hear Mexicans talk about their own heritage, if they say they're Aztecs, it actually has a kind of a political value to it. It isn't necessarily something that refers to some kind of indigenous identity per se or specific ethnicity, indigenous ethnicity. So it's fascinating that this term is being used for these poor couple that come as youth from Salvador and then get involved in all of this exhibitionism in North America.
Sure. So I kind of wanted to lead into we were sort of talking about the lost city material and all of that, and I think one place we might start, which I was not aware before doing the show, that the sort of inspiration for this comes from Stevens writing about people telling him about the Lacandones of the Lacandon rainforest, Lacandon in Chiapas in southern Mexico. And there is a huge fascination for at least a century about the wild Lacandones. It's probably, frankly, much older than that. Can we talk about that a little bit? And I think that kind of will get us into sort of the concept of the lost city.
Sure. Sure.
I think, Marcello, actually, why don't you take that? Because we were discussing, you know, sort of this idea of contact with the Lacandon. So it'd be great if, you know, you elaborate on what we...
Sure. I mean, it's interesting because the Lacandon is... Lacandon image is that of the across time and across the history of research is referred to... The Lacandon is this kind of pure Maya, right? This untouched Maya, this unconquered Maya. What we know from research, of course, is that that there was a group of Maya who did, in fact, were able to avoid being conquered by the Spaniards. They were from the Yucatan Peninsula, the northern part of the Yucatan Peninsula, and during the Spanish incursions and during the Spanish conquest, escaped from northern Yucatan and headed farther south into what were more abandoned or less populated regions in between what are basically the highlands of Guatemala and the lowlands of northern Yucatan. This area in the middle referred to as the Paten today, which is a large, vast region of basically tropical forest, was relatively unpopulated during that time. It didn't really have that much strategic or interest for the Spaniards, or that many resources that they were willing to expend time and energy on. And so it was an area where a lot of people could escape to during the time that the Spaniards were invading both Highland Guatemala and northern Yucatan. And these Lacandones were groups of Maya who were never quite conquered. They were never never Christianized. And they began to live in these areas that were highly depopulated during the 17th and 18th centuries. So to a certain extent, the Lacandones are as much a derivative product of Spanish colonialism as anything else. They weren't Maya that had been there before and had always lived there and had never been in contact. No, they were in fact running away from European contact as best they could during that time. And during the 19th century, especially around the time that Stevens, maybe a little bit before, actually probably even earlier, towards the end of the colonial period in Mexico, the colonial government beginning to try to understand these parts of their territories. Even with one of the first expeditions to Palenque that we were talking about earlier, began to come into contact with these Lacandones. And they sort of became known as these wild Maya, these Maya that had been living all alone and abandoned and not outside of civilization and so forth. They didn't speak Spanish, they weren't Christian and so forth, but they started coming into contact with logging incursions into this vast forested area that is known as the Paten today. So by the time that Stevens is traveling through this area, the Lacandones are an image, if you will, of a mysterious, unknown, and undominated Maya, and so it feeds very much into what we see with Barnum and so forth later. That's why they use the term Lacandon or they some derivative of it to sort of say, this is really the true Maya, right? And that it's interesting because that's been to a certain extent part of archaeology or cultural anthropology in this area for a long time, was this idea of trying to find the true Maya underneath cover. There was a true Maya underneath waiting to break out, as opposed to thinking about it in a much more complex syncretic way.
Well, and like that's sort of like the concept of the folkloric survival, which is driving anthropology. It's driving the creation of folkloric studies. I mean, we've talked about, you know, witches and Celtic spirits and all sorts of things. And that's a lot of that was the same sort of quest for this. There must be something older. There must be something pure that has survived and will put us more in touch with that ancient past. Yeah. What I find absolutely fascinating, Joel Palka has done historical archaeology on Lacandon sites and he finds, glass tools made out of Coke bottles. And goods from New York, and these people were very much plugged into the global economy.
Very much so. And when they were first, when they sort of came into the ethnographic present, that is when we began studying them anthropologically in the last 30 or 40 years, there was still this attempt to render them the last lords of the Maya. In fact, I think one of the famous books about them was called The Last Lords of Palenque. Interestingly enough, this whole story of Palenque keeps coming up.
Yeah, they always seem to be tied into Palenque, yeah.
That's right. And they have actually no historical connection to Palenque in that way. They were there in that region, and they probably actually did a lot of ceremonies in various Maya sites throughout that area in the 17th and 18th centuries, into the 19th century, god pots and so forth that have been collected. But they have no direct, they're not the direct descendants of those who lived in those cities.
I mean, the last royal classical construction would have been, what, around 900, 850 at Palenque?
Right, exactly, late 9th century, early 10th century at the latest. And so there would have been at least, maybe 800 years of abandonment between the time in which Palenque was abandoned and when the Lacandones might have come back into that area, plus or minus, right? But there's still this need to create. And I remember there was a cultural anthropologist at a meeting a long time ago who bemoaned the fact that the Lacandon Maya were installing satellite dishes in their villages so that they could watch the Mexican soap operas, right? And there was this sense,
You're ruining my folkloric survival here, people.
Exactly. And you know, this was something that that is a common theme with the Lacandon, right? Who dress up in their traditional tunics to sell trinkets to tourists when they go to Palenque, and then underneath their tunics they're wearing, you know, Western clothing. And why not, right? So they played a very important role in this kind of the idea of a lost civilization, a lost city. If we penetrate this jungle that is the Petén, right, this area that is basically northern Guatemala and southern Mexico and parts of Belize, that we'll find some original Maya, or we'll find the first Maya, or we'll find, and that's what the Ishi Maya city that they find is really kind of plugging into, right? Is this vast area that nobody knows about, and inside there's probably some survival city that's worth studying.
Let me ask you two then, because you may know the answer to this. The lost city, the concept of the lost civilization, the lost city, is a massive trope in the late 19th century, and then it just sort of continues on. I always associate that with, there's a couple of different ones, but obviously H. Rider Haggard, King Solomon's Mines, She, there are plenty of others, and he did some Aztec ones. But that's often when you're talking about the literature stuff where people point. But right. Of course, Ishi Maya's 30 years before that, give or take, is that concept of the lost city that's sort of preserved through time. Can you think of examples before Ishi Maya?
Well, the earliest documentation about Palenque, which really does have the most continuous trajectory of reports, writings, drawings of any of the Maya sites when you go back into the 18th century. And so the idea that the Lacandon are connected to Palenque is not surprising, even though it's inaccurate. But, you know, I think Waldeck, who was working in the 1830s, was very much convinced, you know, that he was having contact with, you know, what was connected to an ancient culture. As I mentioned before, Kingsborough, Lord Kingsborough, right, who was British, was his patron. He had various expeditions, one of which was sponsored by the Mexican state, which, you know, as a side note, had to do with the conflict between central Mexico and then Chiapas and Yucatan. But his primary patron was Lord Kingsborough, who firmly believed that, you know, there were connections to the Lost Tribe of Israel. Now, Brazor de Bourbourg, who was also active at this point, he's more of a contemporary.
We've talked about him before, yeah, because of Wu and all of that. Yeah.
Right. And so there were all these, I think that, I mean, what comes to mind for me in hearing Marcello and Jeb talk is the idea of authenticity, coming into contact with what is perceived to be authentic. And of course, what is shifting is what that authenticity is. What does authentic mean to, you know, a given explorer, a given group at a particular time? And so that feeds into this idea that the Lacandon are somehow more authentic than, you know, than other. There's a great separation, a divorce that you see, particularly in Yucatan, between the contemporary Maya and then the ancient Maya. And you see this all over the place, right? They can't possibly, right, be descendants of this great culture because they're so degenerate, you know, uncivilized, barbarous, etc. And so I think that part of it also, this quest for authenticity, is about finding that glorious past. And in, you know, in places like Central America, that was everything. This idea that there was a glorious past, or therefore it's a glorious federation or a glorious nation. You know, for Yucatan, it was very much tied to regional identity, in contrast or in conflict with Central Mexico.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And then it ties into, you know, the Cost War and the rebellion.
Absolutely.
At the same time as the American War with Mexico. And we talked about this idea of, oh, these people, they clearly are not, at least culturally and sometimes genetically, they would try to say, the same people of the past. We recently did an episode with Nathan French about Islamic State, but talking about sort of British and French imperialism in the Middle East, and this same phenomenon. It's like, well, there are these Arabs in the way, but they don't have anything to do with, you know, the ancient, really good stuff. That's not really,
right,
them.
Right.
And that's, that right, characterizes right, the whole mound builder question yes. in the American Midwest.
Yeah,
that, you know, our Indians today, they have nothing to do with the great civilization that once existed here.
Right. And right. ultimately, ancient right. aliens is sort of just a even more kind of debased yes. version of all of that.
Right. Right. Well, and that's I think right. also with Stevens, too, that very much enters into his project, because the mound builders, while they were there, they didn't have that exoticism. They didn't have, you know, monumental sculpture, a writing system, which, of course, is what the Maya bring to this study of American antiquity. So Stevens, of course, you know, was trying to bring back, you know, pieces for what was going to be this magnificent museum of American history in New York. I mean, you know, there's this idea that he
bought Copan, right?
Right, and when Kitiguatu, and whether or not that's that actually happened doesn't even matter.
Oh,
it's
really?
The concept of... Yeah, of appropriating, right?
Right?
This idea, this is the time of manifest destiny. I mean, this is when all these ideas looking for an antiquity for the United States. You know, this is when the Mormons are also emerging, too, in terms of that belief system. But Stevens is very much part, or whether or not it was his goal, his writing, his production very much fits into that narrative of an American antiquity that can somehow be linked to the United States, you know, imperially, as well as, you know, commercially, that is offering monumental sculpture, large cities, and of course the glyphs. There's a fascination with the glyphs. And I will mention this, just going back to Galindo, who's writing in the 1830s and is very active in defending the Central American Federation project. You know, that's his whole agenda. That's at least that's what I argue, is someone who does connect the indigenous people to the ancient ruins that he sees. So this idea that Stevens is the first one has just, you know, been popularized when in fact these earlier explorers, you know, do that. Waldeck does go off on some tangents. He was fascinated by albino Maya because, of course, they were white, and Waldeck had his own, you know, theories about, you know, what was going on. But they were all grappling, right, trying to grasp this idea of origin. And once again, authenticity. Yucatan, it's very important to mention that the production that's coming out of Yucatan in the 1840s and 50s, Justo Sierra, O'Reilly, the publications that were mostly in journals, were very much trying to connect Yucatan with the ancient Maya. The indigenous people of, you know, the time, as Jeb mentioned, that will then eventually be part of the caste war, were not connected in any way. They were degenerate, and, you know, and it's a trope you see, you know, all over. You see it in, you know, in Asia and Africa and, you know, in different parts. So, you know, I think that it's very clear that that's what's going on also in the Americas.
Well, let's take our break right now. Actually, it's, yeah. And what I'd like to do when we come back, if possible, is we've talked about sort of the beginning of this concept and how it develops. Can we talk about how archaeology has been sort of, in the Maya region particularly, and maybe more broadly, if it makes sense to, been shaped by this lost city, and how it kind of, this concept of the lost city, and how it sort of, how archaeology has in turn tried to change that idea in various ways.
Interested in archaeology? Want to hear from experts in the field about the latest discoveries and interpretations? Check out The Archaeology Show every other Saturday and let hosts Chris Webster and April Camp Whitaker take you deeper into the story. Check out The Archaeology Show at www.archpodnet.com/archaeology and subscribe, rate, and comment on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and the Google Music Store. That's www.archpodnet.com/archaeology. Now back to the show.
And we are back. And Deb, you wanted to roll us onto the topic of LIDAR.
Well, I had been asking before the break, you know, that, okay, we got this idea of the lost city, and we have archaeology, and we have a whole bunch of archaeologists on here and historians on here. And so I will pose the question, if I wanted to go looking for a lost city, how would I do it? What would I look for? And is that even a question I want to ask?
I think you're going to want a compass and a map and a bullwhip and a fedora.
Yeah, Marcello, is that, right. the answer? Is that the answer?
I would say you first have to ask, when are you asking that question?
Yeah.
Now. Well, that.
Or is there another way to ask that? I mean, go ahead.
I think it's fascinating because you know, we like as archaeologists to think about our research as having more sophistication with regards to the questions we ask of the past. But it remains still an incredibly integral part of my archaeology, the discovery of a site. Modern day archaeology in lowland Maya civilization. And I mentioned this earlier, there's a vast area that is unexplored between the northern Yucatan and highland Guatemala that's known, as I said, the Petén, which are known as the Maya lowlands. And a lot of it is under tropical forest. And it is very difficult, inaccessible to this day. It's very hard to work there. I work there and I have a project there, but it is an incredibly logistically complicated affair because it is in the middle of nowhere. And so the understanding of the penetration of this particular forest in this area and thinking about what's in there, right? The idea, that's, I think, where archaeology, my archaeology still is in that stage of wanting to find out what's there, right? And finding sites and finding, if you will, lost cities, right? So I think it's been, and that's why I said when you asked that question, because it in the 1920s they were asking it, and I think in the 2020s we'll still be asking that question. But obviously the technology has changed, and we've applied new technologies to that very simple question of what lost cities are there. To answer the question of should you be asking that question, that's a much bigger question for which archaeologists have probably lost friendships over. So I think it's a big question to ask is why would we want to ask that question? But I think on a very simple and probably, perhaps a little bit disingenuous level, I would say it's important to know your universe, right? It's important to know what is it that you're dealing with before you ask big questions like how big a civilization were the Lowland Maya, what level of population did they have? Were they complex politically? Were they integrated socioeconomically and so forth? So those are large questions that involve understanding systems. And systems involve understanding networks and sites and populations and how they fed themselves and how they interacted, how they communicated, how they moved around the landscape. The lost city trope itself does have a good archaeological, a good archaeological replacement, if you will, which is trying to understand landscapes, large, broad areas. And one of the areas that has been difficult to study because of the tropical forest has been this area that is the home, if you will, of southern lowland Maya civilization.
And I would like to break in and note really quick. Apparently, a few days ago, Ian Graham passed away. Ian Graham was the pioneers of in the later 20th century of recording Maya hieroglyphic inscriptions behind the corpus of Maya inscriptions at Harvard, and just doing that kind of get on a mule, find a site. He also was big into fighting international looting of monuments and so forth. But yeah, he just passed away at the age of 93 a few days ago, which I think about the exploration of the Petén and not mentioning that would not be a thing I want to do.
It's very true, and he was a titan in our field for exactly that purpose, and he was a man who basically explored. I mean, that was the point of his research, and we have a very long and distinguished legacy of explorers in our field that started, if you will, with Stephenson Catherwood, and to a certain extent, Ian was the inheritor of that tradition of quite literally going and hearing about sites from people or from looters in many cases, and simply heading off into the jungle with a few people that knew how to get there and going and taking a look at it. The site where I work right now was discovered scientifically by Ian back in 1993. So Ian, although he retired just a few years ago, was working on this particular type of research as of 15 years ago. It really was truly a great loss for us. But this kind of work has been undertaken by my archaeologists for a long time, simply asking the question: what level of complexity do we have in the southern Maya lowlands? We know they had pyramids. We know they had writing. We know they had complex building, complex political system. But the extent of that, how big, how many people, and so forth, is still a topic that it has eluded us because it's a very hard for us to investigate at the scale that we need to. So, you know, it's fascinating because to a certain extent, we want to find sites, but we really are now in a period where we're starting to realize, based on all these new technologies, that even the term site itself really doesn't work anymore. We've discussed this a lot in archaeology. What is a site? How do you define it, and so forth? It can be defined in many, many different ways. But you know, the simple kind of sort of instinctive response is: it's a point on a map. It's a dot where you could say, there's a concentration of buildings and other structures. What we're starting to realize when we start looking at LIDAR, which is a technology that's come into play in the last 10 years, is that we really are dealing with a completely anthropogenic landscape. That is, it's a completely built landscape. There isn't a dot in a map, in an area, some settlement, and then empty swaths of land, and then another dot. You know, they are all interconnected in ways that are incredibly surprising to us. So to a certain extent, we're finally being able to answer these questions that have eluded scholars for decades by being able to apply this new technology. This technology that was started by Charles Lindbergh, if you want to know, in the 1920s, right? It was him and in fact,
with A.V. Kidder, I believe.
That's right. Yeah. And one of the other connecting tissue there is my predecessor here at Tulane, Franz Blom, the famous Danish explorer as well. One of these explorer types that, like Ian Graham, was a connecting tissue between Lindbergh and A.V. Kidder and so forth. And they were all able to do the first aerial photography in the 1920s. And they recognized there were buildings popping out of the canopy. And so there were many more sites underneath this mysterious jungle canopy than had been thought. Interestingly enough, by the way, the reason why Charles Lindbergh decided to do this, what I found fascinating, was, again, going back to the question of commerce, he was looking for ways to create an airmail route from Panama to the United States. So the whole concept of Panama, commerce, United States, and exploration comes back even 50, 60, 80 years later in the form of Charles Lindbergh.
He basically saw sites off of, like, basically in Quintana Roo, if I remember correct.
That's right. Yeah. As you would go up the East Coast.
He sometimes gets roped into the Ciudad Blanca stuff. We had Chris Begley on, and some people try to say, yes, it was seen by him. It's like, no, people are sort of smushing those two stories together.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he would have been prospecting that coast to see how airplanes at those times would hug the coast to get back to the States from Panama, right? And so he noticed along the Quintana Roo that where there's some of this canopy, this forest, that there was much more there than what met the eye, and so began this whole process. And it's been a bit of a how do I put this, a kind of a technological game. We've been looking for this silver bullet, technological silver bullet, to help us see through the jungle, right? Since then, and there have been many tries and many attempts, especially since the 80s, none of which really worked as we had hoped, because they ended up giving us way more noise and static than actual data to look at. But this LIDAR has really turned into the first real clear picture of the ground surface of some areas that have never been seen before.
We've talked about LIDAR a little, but basically it's mass laser scanning from an aerial platform like an airplane.
That's right.
And it spits out so many millions of pulses that enough of them get through the foliage. That's the sort of the killer app element. It kind of allows you to strip away virtually leaf cover. Is that basically what we're talking about?
Yeah, it's a radar based technology that emits various wavelengths that are meant to bounce back at different degrees of encumbrance, if you will. And so there are some wavelengths that are able to penetrate the foliage and hit the ground and bounce back. Some that are designed to hit sort of halfway and bounce back. And then those that are hit, are designed to hit the foliage, the top foliage, and bounce back. So in fact, when what you get from LIDAR is a full mapping of the canopy, the entire forest, all the forest levels leading down to the ground. In fact, the ground level is maybe 2 or 3% of all the data that LIDAR is recording, because it's record. You can literally draw, create a map, if you will, a profile of the tree in any one area. So
it's a 3D scan, but of like an area 100 feet tall.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, so you can scan the X-ray almost.
It's almost right. It's seeing through the trees, but it's also capturing all the different
interesting. Things.
But it allows you to layer those images too, doesn't it? You can do it with the foliage on, and you can also remove the foliage to see beneath.
Exactly. And so part of the artistry of this, because it's not always just about a simple technological breakthrough, the artistry is being able to figure out which points are ground points and classify them accordingly so that you get exactly what Sarah just said, how you can then layer it in such a way that you remove the forest cover, you remove the secondary growth, and you just get the ground surface. Fascinatingly, the one example of LIDAR that I saw that showed this being done too well was that it showed the image of Tikal, one of the great Maya cities that is a tourist destination in Guatemala. And one of the subroutines, if you want, one of the algorithms removes all modern day structures because you don't want to see them, right? And because some of the temples at Tikal have been so well consolidated, well built, the LIDAR algorithm removed some of the main temples of the site. Right?
Not ruined enough.
Exactly. It didn't look archaeological to the computer. So obviously, there's still a human element involved with this. You see, we can't remove it, but it does allow us to see the ground surface in a way that is just absolutely impossible by regular pedestrian survey.
So you've been finding roads and just like widespread settlement that really calls into question the whole city concept.
Part of what I did as a graduate student, one of my kind of methodological focus. As major cool stuff in the big temples and so forth, we're relegated to thinking about smaller domestic structures. I did that for my dissertation. So part of my training was essentially settlement survey. And I can tell you the most disheartening aspect, there were some good things and some bad things about LIDAR for us as a discipline. But really, one of the most disheartening aspects, and that really showed us how much we had been missing, was not that we missed, let's say, 30% of everything. Okay, so we didn't catch everything while we were surveying in these areas. We just have to, think of 30% more of everything we find, and then we're okay.
Right.
No, we not only missed things, but we missed entire classes of things. And so things that are there, that not just settlement, but like roads, or causeways, or ditches, or trenches, things that are paradoxically things that are big, wide, that are on the scale of the landscape, moving across.
They look too natural.
They look too natural, there's no one would have wanted as a surveyor to say that's definitely a road that goes 50 miles when there's no precedent for it anywhere else in the Maya lowlands, right? So I'm not going to be the first one to declare that. They'll think I'm crazy, and yet. We see them. I'll be happy, the site that I work at, there's a 1 kilometer road leading from the palace north to another group. And I'll admit it, I jogged over that when I did exercise there for 3 years without realizing that it was a causeway. Then I saw the LIDAR and boom, there it was. It was clear as day. So it is providing us with data that isn't just about increasing the number of sites or the amount of settlement generally, but it's also showing us how widespread certain features, constructive features are. And that will change our way of understanding lowland Maya civilization. And it is, so to a certain extent, it's forcing us beyond the let's find sites paradigm, because what we're finding is just a continued sprawl of settlement, of anthropogenically a modified landscape. That is, people have modified this landscape for centuries, and everything we see there is largely the impact of humans living there and changing things around. There's nothing pristine about that landscape. It was engineered by humans in ways that we were perhaps 30, 40 years ago loath to interpret the Mayas as having done.
Well, and that thing you just said, that it changes what we think about that. That is literally the opposite of the whole Ishi Maya and the Lost City trope. The Lost City trope is, we have this idea and we're going to impose it on you, and right. We really don't care if you like it, versus right. We're going to take this tool, we're going to see what's going on. Oh, things are going on completely different than we expected. Time to right. change what we expect.
That's right. That's right. And that's something that this tool is allowing us to do for the first time. And to a certain extent, you know, it does make us wonder how much of what we've done up to this point has to be completely rethought. But that's where we, I think, perhaps are on the verge of right now, is a paradigm shift for broadly interpreting lowland Maya civilization, not just the classic period, what we call the period that everyone knows about, that collapsed and so forth around 800 or 900, but also the pre-classic, the period that goes as far back as 600 or 700 BCE, and being able to realize that the settlement that we think might be all of a later period is actually even earlier than that. Yeah. So these are some of the fascinating things that LIDAR is letting us see. And so it goes well beyond finding sites now. You know, we're sort of being forced to look at this in a much more kind of complete and comprehensive way, because it's regional in scope.
Can I just want to jump in for a minute. This isn't, of course, my specialty, but I wanted to know what you guys thought about the young Canadian kid who actually, it's a story that was picked up by the international media, and this idea of finding a lost city, you know, with LIDAR. He was, you know, a brilliant, you know, precocious, you know.
Roxanne, I don't know if we let guests ask us questions. That's just the break in pattern there.
Yeah.
No, we did discuss that, Dad. Jeb and who did we have? Who were we discussing that with, Jeb?
I don't think we it came up a couple of times, but I mean, Ken talked about it.
We talked briefly about it.
Yeah, yeah. We were underwhelmed with some of the, you can put a big zodiac on the on the ground concept.
Yeah.
The information that we had did not make it sound very reliable.
Well, I think it works. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I will say one thing about that particular case. What I think that case shows is actually what I was just saying, that there is settlement everywhere, that there are sites everywhere. Right. And it doesn't matter where you look at it or what pattern you decide to put on it, whether it's the zodiac or, you know, pickup sticks or whatever it is that you decide that is going to predict where sites are, you're going to find a site, because it's actually that filled with sites in that
region. You're saying it's kind of like being somewhere between Washington, D.C. and Boston and trying to find a Starbucks.
Exactly.
You're just not trying hard enough if you can't find one.
And connecting the dots any way you want and finding some figure, right? Whether it's George Washington's head or a boar or something.
I think so much of that story, though, was the trope of the, you know, the guy in his garage without any training or experience,
right,
who invents the perpetual motion machine. So it wasn't the particulars aren't important. It's just that, you know, you smartasses with your degrees, you didn't know this, but a 15-year-old kid in Canada.
Exactly.
Figured it out.
Right.
And
right.
And
right.
He
that
found the so lost city. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
The one bit of defense I will provide for him was, they did publish the wrong image in the newspapers. In other words, the image that was widely published of what was essentially a cornfield.
Yeah, it looked like a milpa.
It was a milpa, but was not actually what the image that he was focusing in on as the site that he named. I can't remember the mouth of fire or something like that. So there was another element to this, which was the media also completely messing up.
Oh, the media mishandled something? That would never happen. never happen. Well, so, I mean, I've really appreciated you guys being on the show today, and this has been one of our
chock-filled episodes, but unfortunately, it is coming to an end. So, Marcello, since you were talking last, what are your final thoughts on all of this?
Wow, that's a good question. I think that I can only say that for anyone who's interested in these questions, or at least specifically for my archaeology, stay tuned. There's going to be some really interesting rethinking about what the Maya are and who they were, and some of these questions of lost cities and so forth will come up in different ways. But it will the future is looking bright about the past. How's that?
That's a good one. That's a good soundbite. Yeah. Roxanne, what are your final thoughts?
Well, my final thoughts are that this idea of finding lost cities with, you know, sacerdotal castes is still very much part of the general imaginary, you know, that is still marketed, I think, to the general public, whether it's through Hollywood and the Indiana Jones or through, you know, narratives, through novels that are published, which are countless, this idea of, you know, what happens when you go deep into the jungle and who do you encounter. So I think it's a trope that, you know, has had a long run and continues to run. I mean, different versions of Barnum's, you know, show, his live exhibit. Now, you know, what do we have as entertainment? TV, we have movies, and so it's shifted. But I think that trope that Barnum so brilliantly capitalized on, you know, independent of any, you know, sort of ethical issues, and there were many, but it's a continuous, you know, a continuous engagement with this idea of encounter and lost mythical cities, you know, hidden deep in the forest or the jungle. And, you know, you just go to the movies and you'll find it again. So that's, you know, it's very much of a popular trope that I think will continue.
Jem, what's your final thought?
I think this is great. We brought the history. We brought the science. I thank you both for coming on. And it's funny, Roxanne, what I was thinking about, I just was teaching some high school students, and they were fantastic. And one of the things every single one of them knew was that movie Road to El Dorado, which is every single one of the tropes we were talking
there
about.
There you go.
It's the Disney one?
It's
cast.
Also Disney. I mean.
Yeah, just all of that. One. So thank you.
To be fair,
yes.
To be fair, those are two very entertaining characters.
Oh, yeah. No, the kids, we were taught the ball game, and they're like, can you please show us? Like, it's not accurate. It's like, we don't care. We want to see it again. So, no, they loved that idea. But, yeah, just thank you for bringing on this kind of we love to do the history. Like I said, it's a difficult episode for me to not say Victorian.
there you go.
And also bringing the science. So thank you quite a bunch.
Thank you all very
You're
much.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Ken, do you have a final thought?
Yeah, just one last thing. If you read P.T. Barnum's autobiography, he kind of sheepishly admits that, yeah, he pulled a lot of humbug, but he justifies it and rationalizes it by saying, yeah, but that's what gets the people to walk through the doors of the museum. Mm-hmm. That's what gets the asses in the seats, and then they get the real stuff. Right. So, you know, I'm not sure that's justifiable, but at least Barnum did that. Oh, and one very last thing. Again, a shout out to Ian Graham. Back in the day, Horizon, the BBC Horizon, did an episode on Eric Von Däniken's The Case of the Ancient Astronauts. And Ian Graham was the guy who took everybody into the Temple of the Inscriptions and did the best, wonderful, nice. And perfect deconstruction in his very British way of explaining what the sarcophagus lid really meant. And it was just, I still show that in class. After, you know, they ask about that and they say, if you listen to this, you cannot come away thinking that that's an extraterrestrial astronaut. So that was a wonderful contribution on his part. And thank you. This was absolutely wonderful.
You're welcome.
Roxanne and Michelle, thank you so much for coming on. You definitely have given us a ton of information about this, and I hope that our listeners take away a great deal from this show. And if you have any questions or comments, you can email them to us at archiefantasies@gmail.com, and we will have show notes with hopefully the pamphlet and everything else in there for everyone to look at the website. So thank you both for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having us.
Have a good night.
Bye.
Bye.
No, we don't do dinosaurs.
Thanks for listening. We hope you've enjoyed it. Our music was provided by Archaeosuit Productions. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe and rate us on iTunes or Stitcher and share us wherever you use social media. You can contact us with your questions, comments, or angry email at archiefantasies@gmail.com. You can follow the podcast at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archiefantasies. You can follow the blog at www.archiefantasies.com and get updates on Tumblr and Twitter at @archiefantasies. You can also look for us on Facebook. If you're looking for the show notes for this episode, go to the podcast website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archiefantasies. Thanks again for listening.
No, we don't do dinosaurs. No, we don't do dinosaurs. We don't do dinosaurs.
This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.